Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Madeline Albright is going to be with us this hour of the program. Always a great pleasure to have a chance to speak with her. She's written a very personal book that takes us to faraway places with unpronounceable names, places that we should care about. This story was really many, many years in the making. As she writes in the intro to her book, she was 59 when she began serving as U.S. Secretary of State and thought that by then she knew all there was to know about her past, who her people were, and the history of her native land. And she found that that was not in the case at all, and it led her on a really 15-year examination of her family. She, and it's found, I should say, the title of the book, in her new book, Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. Madeline Albright is also the author of Madam Secretary, The Mighty and the Almighty, Memo to the President, and Read My Pins, which was a lovely book. I think that was the last occasion on which we spoke with her. She was U.S. Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001. She also served in the National Security Council as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and on Capitol Hill. She was born in Czechoslovakia, spent the war years in London. Her family tried to return to Czechoslovakia. The communists took over, and they came to the United States. And that's just the brief outline of her story. Here's our phone number if you would like to join our conversation with Secretary Albright. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Secretary Albright, a great pleasure to speak with you again. Hi.
Great to be with you, Kathleen. Thank you so much.
I think the last time we spoke, it was about your great book with pins. I love that book and the pictures in the book. It was just terrific.
Well, it's a fun book. This one's a little bit different.
And, yes, it is.
I am thrilled to be able to talk about any of my books. So thank you so much.
This book, so much soul searching went into this, so many trips to your homeland, and you had to encounter some real horrors that the world took in, but you had to take in on a very personal level. Can you tell me what prompted the book?
Well, the chronological story is the following. You introduced me with the basic facts, and what happened was I had clearly had jobs before I went to the United Nations, but at that stage in 1993, when I got there, there were a number of profiles done about me, and so all of a sudden I became a public figure, and I started getting letters from people in the years, and many of them were in Czech, which I do read, but in inscrutable handwriting, and some were kind of the normal things that public people get, is like send money or I need a visa, and some had facts about my parents, but none of them ever kind of added up. For instance, somebody wrote and said they'd gone to high school with my father in 1915, which would have been impossible since he was born in 1909. Or they had the little villages that they came from wrong, or the dates or the names. And so it was not until November 1996, when I was being vetted to be Secretary of State, I was in the White House counsel's office, and they were kind of asking the normal questions that they do in these things, you know, have you paid your taxes or do you have a nanny or things like that. And then they said at the end of the interview, is there anything about you that we should have asked that we didn't that you would like to tell us? And I said, well, I had gotten this letter that had all the facts right. And that they, in that letter, it had been said that they knew my families that were of fine Jewish background. So I said that I might be of Jewish background. And they said, well, so what? The president isn't anti-Semitic. And so over the holidays, I told my children about it, and they and their husbands, and everybody was intrigued and fascinated and thought it just added to what was already a complex story. And then what happened, as you probably know, journalists, when somebody's been named to a post, you can't talk to journalists until you've been confirmed. And so Michael Dobbs from the Washington Post wanted to do a profile of me, and so my office gave him names of people that he might be able to talk to. And so on the day that I was confirmed, he came into my office and started showing me some documentation, among them these really disgusting cards that the Nazis had kept. They were very organized. on which were transport dates and names, and he said, all these people that are your relatives died in concentration camps. And so it's one thing to find out about having a Jewish background.
Yes.
It's another to find that out. And that's really, and I couldn't go because I was being Secretary of State. And so I asked my brother and sister to go to the Czech Republic to begin unearthing the facts and working through the story. So that's the genesis of it.
And you describe this moment about a trip to Prague's Pinkus Synagogue, where the names of your family members were among the 80,000 inscribed on the walls as a memoriam. That must have been such a moment.
Well, such amazing. In the following way also, I had gone to Prague a number of times in the 80s, and the Pinkus Synagogue was under reconstruction. There, I think whoever your listeners have been to Prague, that Jewish cemetery is one of the more amazing places that anybody could go to. And I had gone in 96 when I went to Prague with, at that stage, First Lady Hillary. We went into the Pinkus Synagogue, and it looks as though it's all, unless you know its names, it kind of looks like very fine black lines on wallpaper. And, of course, since I didn't know anything, it never occurred to me to look. And so in 97, when I went back on an official trip, I went to the Pinkus Synagogue, and the caretakers there showed me the exact place where my grandparents' names were. And, one, it was just unbelievably sad in many different ways. And in another, kind of thank goodness for what my parents had done, or my name and theirs would be on the wall, and my brother and sister would not have existed.
And what did your parents do? They moved out of the country, didn't they, during the war?
Well, my father was a Czechoslovak diplomat, and very much of a generation of interesting young people. You know, Czechoslovakia is a brand new country. It started in 1918, very much at the impetus of Woodrow Wilson and the 14 points and self-determination, and very linked to the United States. And my parents were of that young, new generation of people that call themselves Czechoslovaks, and he was very political and very committed to foreign policy. And when the Nazis took over, he escaped with my mother and me from Czechoslovakia to go to England to join the government in exile, which is where we were during the war. My father broadcast, he was in charge of broadcasting, and he broadcast over BBC all throughout the war.
And you were a very young girl during those years. Your memories are of bomb shelters. Your memories are of blacked out places where people live to keep the light from coming through. Tell me about those very early memories. How many you have?
Well, you know, I was two when we got there. So my memories come kind of from 3 to 4 and beginning at that stage. We lived in an apartment house in Notting Hill Gate, which now in London is a nice kind of trendy section, but at that stage was a place where refugees were. And so the building that we lived in was filled with other refugee families. And when the air raid siren started, we went down to the air raid shelter, which actually was a cellar with hot water pipes and gas pipes. I remember hearing my father later say, you know, it was good to be there, but had a bomb hit, we'd be dead anyway. Mm. And I remember that. And when I went back to visit 2 years ago, when we were working on the book, I went down to the cellar, which had not been fixed in any way, and had this kind of out-of-body experience of seeing the same old hideous green paint that I had seen on the walls when I went to sleep there. So we lived in London all through the Blitz. I went to school, my father broadcast, and then we moved out to the countryside, to Walton-on-Thames, where the air raids obviously continued. And at that stage, one of the things that happened was people bought these big steel tables that it was said that if a bomb hit your house and you were under it, you would be saved. So we had one of these tables, and we played around it and ate on it and slept under it. My father was an air raid warden, and I was a very proper little English girl.
Hmm. And you write, just skipping ahead here, because we got after the war as well, This is, you've had an extraordinary life, I keep thinking,
well,
haven't you?
Well, it certainly is ending up.
Oh, my gosh. It's really extraordinary.
Yeah.
So even while the war was underway, the Czechoslovakian communists, you write, had set out to become the country's most thoroughly organized political faction. This is happening toward the end of the war in your homeland?
Well, the interesting thing about this was, and this is where history makes a difference. As I said, Czechoslovakia was a new country, and it needed protection. And in 1935, the Czechoslovaks signed a non-aggression treaty with the French. And the French commitment was if Czechoslovakia was attacked, they would come and defend it. The Soviet Union attached itself to that treaty and said if the French went in to defend under whatever circumstance, they would also come. What happened after Munich, which was an agreement that was made by the British and French over the heads of the Czechoslovaks, they never were in the room, with the Germans and Italians, Czechoslovakia was dismembered. Hitler marched in. The French did not honor their alliance, and the Soviets said that they would have. And so they kept a certain degree of, there was a certain degree of confidence in them among the Czechoslovaks, which they didn't have in the West. The communists, what is interesting about Czechoslovakia during the interwar period, they had a legal socialist and a legal communist party. Some of the exile people went to Moscow, while people like my father went to London. And those in Moscow were beginning to organize what would happen after the war. And then I'm sure you remember, is there was this weird period between 1939 and 1941 when Hitler and Stalin made a pact.
Right.
So the communists were kind of lost at that point, trying to figure out who they were really for. But then after that, when Russia was invaded, there was a communist resistance in Czechoslovakia directed out of Moscow. That then ultimately was able to be much more organized than anybody else. And they did win the plurality in the first free elections in 1946.
Hmm. What's fascinating about your book is that you're a student of history as well. And so you've got the history of what's happening in your homeland and what's happening with Hitler and the Soviet Union and the British. And it's also this intense personal story of what happened to your family. And let's move to that for just a moment.
I try to do, if I can, is the book is kind of in three layers. The inner core is this personal story.
Right.
Then it is within this historical period, 37 to 48, which is truly fascinating in terms of what happened in itself, and then the effects it still has on our lives. And then the third layer is about the real difficulty of decision-making, questions of leadership, moral value. So that's kind of cliff notes to them.
Yeah, I'm glad that you write about some of your heroes because they're worth remembering, and some of them have died just recently, too. Let's go to the story of your... So you're in London. Your parents are obviously holding these very deep secrets from you about your grandparents and all the relatives that you've had. And I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about that, because they were holding in something that was of such unimaginable horror that it's still unimaginable horror.
Well, the thing that they were very young, which is something that I have really realized more as I've gotten older, when they left Czechoslovakia. My mother was 29, my father was 30. They left their families there, and I believe that nobody could have imagined what was going to happen. And I think that's something that has to be kept in mind, that nobody could visualize the barbarism of the Nazis. And as I said, my father wanted to be with the government in exile. And my father did broadcast, so he generally knew the news coming out of Czechoslovakia, I presume, because there were some of the broadcasts really respond to that and try to energize the domestic audience. I knew nothing about this, and we lived, as I said, first in London, then in the country. My uncle, my father's brother, was also in England with his family, and then there was a young girl that lived with us, and at the time, all I knew was that she was my cousin, and she had come to be in school in London during the war. The story turns out, and this is one of the tragedies, is that she came on a transport that was set up by a British stockbroker, Nicholas Winton, that was trying to save, and did save, Jewish children. And one of the really tragic stories and one of the decisions in life is she had a little sister, and her parents, and by the way, the cousin told me this last year, so you learn things late, that her parents had not wanted to put the little sister on because they thought she was too little and that it would be better for her to be protected with them at home. They then were sent to a concentration camp, and she died a week before the liberation. And then so vast numbers of my family were, in fact, interned in concentration camps and died. And my parents, I'm speculating here, must have known, but I did not, and they didn't tell us. And I think they were incredible in terms of dealing with their worries and their grief.
Mm-hmm. And when you, and I'm sure that you've asked yourself this a million times, Secretary Albright, why do you think they held that close? Why didn't they tell you? Were they protecting you from something?
Well, I think at that stage during the war, I mean, you have to remember, you know, it was between the ages of 2 and 5, so, and 6, 7, you know, I mean, between 37 and 48. So while this was going on, I really was a little girl, so incapable of understanding. The question is why they didn't tell me any of this when we came to the United States. And again, I have to, or when we came back to Czechoslovakia, I was only told that my grandparents were dead and they were old. I mean, and which I was perfectly willing to believe. This sounds very cold, but I don't remember my grandparents at all. I know pictures. You know, I left when I was 2 years old.
Yes.
And so the story at that time when we left was your grandparents died and of old age. We then came to the United States, and again, here I am speculating, is I think they really, first of all, wanted to have a new life and put this horror behind them, and I think that they felt that they wanted to protect us, my brother and sister and me, and that there was really not a necessity to talk about it, and why make us also carry the burden that they had? And one of the things that I found in the course of writing this book, and it does make me sound really like a pack rat, but I had many boxes in my garage that I had never opened. And in them, I found a manuscript of a novel that my father had written. I knew he'd written a novel. I found it hard to believe, given that he was a historian and a political scientist. And the novel is very sad, and it's about a young diplomat who goes back to Czechoslovakia and looks for his family, and they're all dead. And he tries to find out about them, and he meets some old man in a village, and he starts asking him questions and discovers that the man is a deaf mute. And the words are that he didn't want to talk about it or wouldn't talk about it, and I think that was kind of the motto or a symbol that they would never talk about it.
I was walking my dog yesterday afternoon, and I've been reading your book this week, and I stopped at one of my neighbors who has just returned from Israel. Her family is very, very religious and very Jewish, and she, we were talking about you and the fact that you were going to be on tomorrow, and I told her a little bit of your story, and she said, well, she knew quite a few people, actually, whose parents had become mostly Catholic and who had hidden what had happened in the war, that it was not, your story is not all that, even though it seems shocking right now, that there are other people, and you've heard from them as well, who have similar stories, that identities were completely changed.
Absolutely. You know, first of all, I've got to tell you, if you're going to walk your dog, you can listen to me. I actually recorded the whole thing.
Well,
myself.
I didn't know that.
Yes. But anyway, I thought I'd pass that on.
Thank you.
What I think is interesting is at the time that mine came out, it did seem very sensational. And also, I had just become Secretary of State. And there were you know, allegations that I had lied, and how could a smart woman not know, and all that. And I have to say it was very painful in that way, because I hadn't lied. And the way that I felt was that I had just been named to represent my country in a marathon as the first woman Secretary of State. I was the first woman to ever run in this marathon, and that they had given me a very heavy package to carry as I ran and also unwrap. That's the only way I can describe it. What has happened since, and I think partially my story evoked this, is that there have been many stories like this, and people have written to me about it, and so it's not that sensational. People came to America to have a new life, and they couldn't bring the people back, and they had children, and I think it's completely understandable as to why this would happen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we need to pause for a moment and we'll return. We'll welcome phone calls as well. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is our guest this hour. Her new book is a very deep personal story of remembrance and war from 1937 to 1948. Prague Winter is the name of the book, and it outlines where she was during the war years, her discovery of her family's Jewish past, and we have yet to talk about their becoming Roman Catholics, her discovery of what happened to many members of her family who died in concentration camps. She writes very poignantly about one of those camps, which the Germans called a spa. We will hear about that and more. And welcome your calls. I hope some of you have had a chance to read the book. It's on many levels, historical, personal, very moving. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And you can also leave messages on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Madeleine Albright, our guest this hour, her book is Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948, which is also on tape, which she reads, which is good because she has a good voice. Let's go to phone calls. Moira in Madison. Hi, Moira.
Hi. I have a question about the crypt. I believe that you talked about this in your book.
Yes.
I saw you the other night on The Daily Show, and you mentioned the heroism of some of the people who were resistance fighters, basically. And I had a chance to go to the Czech Republic, and I visited the crypt. Is it in St. Cyril's Church?
Yes.
And I wonder if you could talk about what happened there, and I don't know if you actually go into the bombings at Lidice afterwards, but just talk a little bit about the bravery of the people who worked in the resistance there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. This is the story. There was a man, Richard Heinrich, who was known as the Reich's protector, i.e. Hitler's representative in Bohemia, which was the part that was left of Czechoslovakia, Slovakia having been made an independent country under a pro-Nazi Slovak. And what happened was, the decision was made in London by the government in exile to send some parachutists into Prague in order to assassinate this man. And that in itself is one of the really hard decisions. Kathleen, we were talking about the decisions. They knew that there would clearly be retributions if something like that were done. On the other hand, this man was not just the Reich's protector, but he was the inventor of the final solution of the Holocaust.
Mm.
And he was going to be transferred to France in order to make it all even larger. So a decision was made by the government to send in three parachutists in order to assassinate him. And the plan was very complicated and required these people to be hidden and the plan to do it. There was a woman, Mrs. Moravec, who in fact was just an ordinary woman who took them in and also arranged to hide them in other places. The bottom line is they accomplished the assassination, which was the only assassination of a Nazi high-level official through the war. And what happened also was that there had been an additional parachutist that had joined them who ratted on them. And what basically happened was the people were hidden in a crypt of a church, and they were able to hide for quite a long time. They sent them goods and everything, but ultimately, because of the help of this man, they were able to find them. And this wonderful Mrs. Moravets, in the end, takes a cyanide capsule because she didn't want to give them away. So it is, and the story is a complicated one in the following way. The assassination worked. As a result of it, the Germans decided to level a whole town, Lidice. And so thousands of people died. So there were obviously a lot of criticism as to whether it was worth it to do it. And two other things happened. One is that the Czechoslovak government exile had trouble being fully recognized by the British, but as a result of this, they were. And the other, more personal, the day after Heydrich died, my maternal grandmother was sent on to camps in the East. So it's an amazing story of many different kinds. I think that, Moira, you might agree that in the book it's kind of a page-turner, if you've read that part yet. But the whole story is a fascinating one in terms of the events, the unintended consequences of decisions, the intended ones, how you make a decision like that.
Let's, and there are so many page turners. Let's talk about, I found this a really interesting story. Himmler promising the Red Cross an opportunity to visit a labor camp in Poland, and the delegation's visit to the, quote, spa, unquote. You write about it in the book. It's a fascinating story. And was this the place where one of your relatives was?
Yes. I mean, this was a concentration camp in Bohemia, the Czech part, called Terezin, and in German, Terezinstadt. And it itself was interesting. It was a fortress originally that was built by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Gavrilo Princip, the man who assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, was there as a prisoner. And then there was a garrison town attached to it, which was a fairly attractive town. What the Nazis did was to advertise this place as a spa. And a lot of Jews, I think, knew that they were going to have to be segregated, and already there were a bunch of different rules about living in ghettos. And so some of them voluntarily went to this place. And when, of course, they got there, it was completely different and a disgusting place in many different ways of people being piled on top of each other. And then a very sadistic, barbaric concept that the Nazis had, they created a group of Jewish elders, and then the Jewish elders were those that were to choose their fellows to be sent on to the death camps. Terezin was not a death camp. People died there of so-called natural causes. One of my grandfathers died of typhoid there. And then other relatives of mine were there. What happened was, as you suggested, there was a promise to the International Red Cross that they could go to camps, and this is the one they went to. And what happened, the Germans knew when they were coming. They prepared for it by cleaning up a whole area. It's on display now, and it looks like kind of a basic athletic locker room or a bathroom with lots of sinks and bathrooms, and it looks perfectly fine. The bottom line is the people that went on this mission were unprepared for anything. They didn't ask questions, and they gave the whole thing a whitewash. And so, for me, that's a real lesson in terms of what monitors are supposed to do, of being prepared, asking questions, not being led around by information ministers or tour guides. And and it is another one of the huge tragedies here of a whitewash by the International Red Cross.
Right. Let's go to Sean in Milwaukee. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Hi, good. The only question I have is, we're studying this right now. I'm currently in school, a lot of the Holocaust things and what's going on. And one of the questions that we were presented with is, how do people obtain power? How do they come into power, especially people like Hitler, and how they can really rule this whole entire area and what phase kind of goes? And how does that come to happen?
Good question. So, first of all, I think the part that is very difficult for all of us to absorb is Hitler was elected. And it came after a period of terrible economic disaster in Germany, and a sense that the rulers that were there then weren't doing anything about it. And he was a good speaker and a great demagogue, and he got elected. We talk a lot about the power of technology now. There was power of technology then, the radio and loudspeakers and various ways that Hitler used that. And he made promises that he would improve things. And he then also needed a scapegoat, so he began to blame the Jews there. Then, and I think this is another part, not just how they obtain power, but how they maintain power and enlarge what they want to do. So and this is something that I really could see a lot in doing research for this book, is how tired the British and French were from World War I. They had lost a lot of people. They were really scarred. And they did not feel that, or they didn't want to go to war, and they didn't think that Hitler was that bad, frankly, or they didn't accept the fact that he'd actually written a book, Mein Kampf, which said that he had larger plans. And they began to give away territory to him. So they first gave him the Tsar land, then the dismemberment of Czechoslovakia was a part of feeding the beast, mm-hmm. appeasing him, because they did not think, and Kathleen, you opened your program this way, and this was Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of England, said, why should we care about faraway places with people
yes.
with unpronounceable names.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't see how what was happening in Czechoslovakia would ever affect them.
Mm-hmm.
It was far away, and they didn't see the connection. So some of it is wishful thinking. Leaders, you know, Chamberlain hoped that Hitler would change. Then President Roosevelt actually hoped that Stalin would change. So I write about the importance of leaders not making decisions based on hopes and wishes, but have to be factual.
And yet you write about, in your book, Germany's long-time plan to transform your homeland into a very important part of the Reich and what they did. When were they doing that? It's sort of hard to believe that people weren't seeing that this was horrible, what was happening, and there must have been some kind of plan, and we better pay attention to this now.
Well, in some ways, it was willful blindness, but the part that I find also hard is the United States wasn't interested. I have been a great believer in the goodness of American power, and we were also going through a phase of isolationism, not wanting to be involved. And I think people, just decided to ignore it. And partially really was the fear of another world war. And that's where the word appeasement kind of got its symbolic value of appeasing, thinking that if you gave Hitler a little bit, he wouldn't want it all. And in retrospect, it is truly hard to believe.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Sean, thanks. Steve in La Crosse, hi.
Hi. I kind of come at this a little different. I have, first off, I'm very honored to speak with Mrs. Albright. I appreciate it very much. I have relatives who live in the Sudetenland and were alive during the war, and she was about 12 or so. So, and they live north of Prague in a little town called Prachen, and it's fairly close to the main line railroad from Terezinstadt over into the east. And so I'm sure she had to see trains. She was about 12 at the time, but she had an uncle who used to deliver various whatever to the town in Terezinstadt, and she always mentioned about how he'd come back, and he was visibly upset and really didn't say much, and they would ask him what was going on, and he never would tell them. But I'm sure they knew something was going on. I'm sure also they didn't know the exact particulars. But they weren't Nazis, but on the other hand, they weren't anti-Nazi either. I think they were probably just, as you would say, willful ignorance and willful blindness and just wanted to live their lives and continue on. But they weren't upset that Hitler took over the Sudetenland, but they weren't totally joyful about it either. They stayed there after the war simply because they had an American visa from 1922, and so the communists allowed them to stay there, and so they still live there. And I communicate with them every once in a while. Mm. In fact, I'm going to see them next year.
Hmm. Secretary Albright.
So interesting, because the Sudetenland story is an interesting one. First of all, as I said, Czechoslovakia was formed as a result of Woodrow Wilson and self-determination. But it was not a homogeneous country. I remember there were the Czechs and the Slovaks, and then there was a very large German minority that lived in the Sudetenland, and it's called that because it's south of Germany, though it's north of, in the northern part of the country, and then Hungarians and then Ruthenians on the end. So it was not a homogeneous place. The issue, again, in looking at the history, a lot of Germans that lived in Sudetenland were, in fact, represented in the government and had bureaucratic jobs of a variety of kind. But there were also people that were unhappy there under Czechoslovak rule. And there was a man there called Konrad Henlein, who was a Nazi and basically kind of the tool of Hitler in agitating even more that the Germans in Sudetenland were not being treated properly, and the excuse was that they wanted to be incorporated into Germany, and that is how this movement, the appeasing aspect, happened, because Hitler kept saying these are Germans, they should be in Germany, and the Czechs are treating them terribly. Now, not all the Germans that lived in the Sudetenland, as you pointed out, Stephen, were pro-Nazi, and they were in a very bad situation, because there's no question that during the war the Czechs didn't trust them at all, and there was kind of collective guilt assigned, and I think that they were in a very bad shape. Now, one of the things that I found out as I was looking through working on this, I had never really focused on the fact that the Czechs treated the Germans in Sudetenland terribly after the war. And one can understand why, because of revenge and everything, and terrible things. But there were a lot of innocent people that were kind of also swept up in an anti-German feeling. And when I was involved in all the issues in the Balkans, and I kept accusing the Serbs of ethnic cleansing and moving populations around, some of my people that I dealt with would say, well, what do you think about what your people did to the Sudeten Germans? Mm. It's ethnic cleansing. Because they were then pushed out, most of them, out of Czechoslovakia, their property seized. And so the Sudetenland story is a very sad one and a complicated one, and that there's no such thing, and shouldn't be, as far as I'm concerned, of completely homogeneous nations.
Madeleine Albright is our guest this hour. Her new book is Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. She, of course, was Secretary of State from 97 to 2001 in this country. She's also had many positions on Capitol Hill, on the National Security Council, and also as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. We'll take more phone calls, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Madeleine Albright is our guest this hour. You ask, of course, and you can't help but ask these huge questions as you look at your family history and history of this time of the world. But I want to hear your thoughts on this. You ask in your book, what fascinates me and what serves as a central theme of this book is why we make the choices we do, what separates us from the world we have, and the kind of ethical universe envisioned by someone like Václav Havel, who's a hero of yours. What prompts one person to act boldly in a moment of crisis and a second to shelter in the crowd? What do you think?
Well, I think it's an unresolved question, and the issue is that within each of us, I think, there is the really good, clear, morally correct person who does shelter the homeless and stands up for everything. And also, there are those who either are willfully blind or collaborate. And I think that the hard part is to really try to sort out how you would behave in any given situation. You know, I had gone back to Czechoslovakia in the 80s when it was under communism and I was doing research. And I looked around, everybody looks the way I do, and I thought, what would have happened if we had stayed? How would I would have hoped I would have been part of Václav Havel's Charter 77. Mm. But how does one, you know, I think these are the issues and that we have to ask a lot of questions, and the journey of seeking the truth and understanding what moral values are is part of what this is all about.
Let's go to Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi, ladies. How are you doing?
Hi.
Say, Secretary Albright, I just wanted to say that this is an honor, first of all, to speak to you, and an epic moment for me. One of the things that I wanted to bring up was I've been a big follower of Webster Tarpley, and recently he was talking about World War II and the rise of Hitler. And one of the things that he went into was the help of Prescott Bush, which is George Bush's grandfather, and the help of the central bank from the British Empire to put Hitler into power, with the understanding that they would use Germany as a rising force and a power in that region to go and wage war against Russia. But so many other notes, I guess it obviously changed and went so many different directions. But really, when the people were behind him in voting Hitler in, it was with the help and the money and the financing and the propaganda machine from the British Empire and Prescott Bush. I wanted to know your insights on that.
Well, I don't know specifically about Prescott Bush, but there's no question that there were many in the United Kingdom and even among Americans who were more afraid of communism and Bolshevism than they were of Hitler and Nazism. And you see that in any number of books and ways of looking at things. You talk about Prescott Bush as a Bush ancestor. I obviously am a Democrat, but I can say that Joseph Kennedy, the father of President Kennedy, right, was ambassador in England and sent terrible reports back that, in effect, were pro-German. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was a sense, and among our great heroes, Lindbergh, you know, in this country, that there were those who, and the simplest way of putting it is they were more afraid of communism than they were of Nazism.
I don't want the hour, and we'll go back to phone calls in a moment, to go by without, you just took in so much writing this book, 15 years, going to all these places, dealing with what your parents had done, and I'm sure missing them again. It's, I mean, this is big, big, big stuff that's in this book. So how did you absorb all of this and your family? It's a change of identity. It's coming to terms with the fact that somebody in your life who really influenced you, I think, in major ways, your father, honorable man, you loved him dearly and admired him. You had to deal with the fact that there was a whole other life here. How did you take all of this in, and how did your children take all of this in, Secretary Albright?
Well, it clearly was a huge discovery to find out you're not who you think you are.
Right. Yeah.
On the other hand, what I found interesting, you know, I have been asked, how did all this change how I viewed things? In many ways, it didn't. I mean, I was brought up with the right value system in terms of what was good and evil and standing up and defending what you thought was right. That I got from my parents. And I also think, in terms of family values and all that, I really do think. I have tried to explain to myself why they didn't tell me. And I have decided, and I think I'm right about this, that it was basically done to protect us, not in terms of trying to create a new identity, but to protect us. I decided that I wanted to write this book because I think it's the way to honor all of those who died and people that I didn't know but were clearly closely related to me, and also to tell my father's basic story and my mother's in terms of their ability and that they symbolized in many ways human resilience, the desire to move on, to that you can't live looking backwards, that you have to do the best you can to make a difference. And so if I learned anything from my parents, it was to make a difference. And this may sound a little glib, but I think that what I learned was that an awful lot of people paid forward, and I have to pay back.
Mm. And what about your faith? Are you still a Catholic?
Well, this is how I describe myself. I was raised a Catholic and became an Episcopalian and found out I was Jewish.
So right,
I
of
am,
course.
I am a woman, a mother, a grandmother, a big D, small D Democrat, a professor, a businesswoman, and like America, I am indivisible.
That's quite an answer. Annie in Milwaukee. Hi, Annie.
It is an honor to speak with you and with the ambassador. I happen to be, after 25 years, rereading Herman Wouk's Winds of War and War and Remembrance. And though it is a novel, what you were describing happening in Czechoslovakia, he really focused on Poland. And the story is scapegoating, how the State Department is afraid to act on information, how they demand more and more information. My question has always been to myself, how would I act in a similar circumstance? Would I try to protect myself? The whole thing. I want your book, and I thank you for writing it.
I think I'm so glad you said that, because these are the issues that I raise. And I think that they are, I try to answer. I mostly speculate because I don't have all the answers. But I do think that one of the issues that's out there right now that we have to deal with is, one could argue that we didn't all have the information during World War II. Now we have information about everything that's going on everywhere. So what are the responsibilities? Do we have to be everywhere? What is the role of the United States? How do we work with other countries? This is out of a period a long time ago, 70 years ago, but the bottom line is that many of the issues that I raise are completely germane today.
Thank you, Annie. Dale in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, good morning. Wonderful conversation and insights that only this kind of radio will bring. Thanks. I have a question. You had mentioned during your discussion that there was really a failure of some of the people who were granted that rare privilege to get into these areas and sort of bought hook, line, and sinker what their escorts were showing them. Move forward a little bit of time, and it seems to me I'll probably misrepresent his name, but was it David Keyes or Keyes that was a nuclear weapons investigator in the Mideast? He seemed to be a very tenacious fellow, you know, looking for what was there and not giving up if there were items that were being hid. That takes, I guess the best word is guts, to be able to be that good. How do we ensure that we have gutsy people available, and how can you advise people to not be intimidated by the terrorism we have and the risk of, you know, physical damage and bodily harm?
Well, this is why I raised the issue, because I knew him, and I was at the United Nations at the time, and getting the reports was very important. And the person has to be smart and ask a lot of questions, and then the international system has to protect them and require it of them. What I think is interesting right now, though the situation, you know, nothing is exactly the same, but is the monitors that are going into Syria right now. And there are not enough of them. That's one issue. And to what extent are they going to be able to really speak up about what's going on? The secretary, former Secretary General Kofi Annan, has praised them, but has been very concerned about how the process is happening. And so it's a combination of getting the right people and then the right international protection and will of countries to follow up so that they are, because the people that went into Iraq were part of a United Nations operation that was, when I was at the UN, we constantly reviewed the kind of work they were doing and shone the light on the good things that they were doing. So it's a combination of the good, brave, smart people and a system that will demand that they're allowed to do their work.
Mm. Thank you very much for the call. Madeleine Albright, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing this fascinating, fascinating book. Thanks.
Kathleen, thank you, and to all the callers. That was a great conversation. I'm very grateful to all of you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our pleasure. Madeleine Albright, who has shined the light on her life and on World War II as well in her new book, which is titled Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War from 1937 to 1945. She has some people just because of the time they're born and who they are and who their parents are, live extraordinary lives, and hers is definitely one of them. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. They were good and thoughtful and illuminating. We'll be with you again Monday at 9 o'clock. All Things Political, starting the week for us at 9 a.m. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.